Here we are again, folks, with another episode of the Scarlet Thread Society. As always, we're going to go through a few warnings and safety precautions before we begin. Please make sure your doors are locked, your windows are closed, your mirrors are covered, and that you have a little bit of tobacco or salt to ward yourself as necessary. You know, perhaps if you have a juju bag, this would be a good time to grab one. Now, with all that taken care of and out of the way, let's get into it. First things first, our favorite part of the show, our listener stories. The first one comes to us. You can call me Jordan or my Twitter handle at ClusterheadJWI1. I have a couple stories to share. I hope you enjoy them. I lived in Oklahoma for 5 years and worked as a CNA, nurse's aide, in several positions over that time. My first job after receiving my CNA was at a long-term care facility that also had a rehab hall, generally for people who had surgery and only needed care until they recovered. I worked the night shift, usually on a full care hall, but got the rehab hall one very cold night in mid-January. It was an easy shift. Many of my residents at the time needed little assistance. I started the shift at 11 p.m., going to each room of the hall, including the empty rooms, to remove trash, check on each resident, deliver bedtime snacks, turn off lights, etc., etc. After those tasks, I moved to a chair at the front of the hall where I could see all the call lights above the doors and began some paperwork. Every door was closed, hall lights dimmed. A little after midnight, sitting alone on this hall, I heard a door close at the far end of the hall. I did not hear the door open and saw nobody in the hall. I got up and started walking down the hall. Nothing seemed out of place, except I could hear some faint noise from one of the unoccupied rooms. When I entered the room, the lights and TV were on. Knowing I had been in this room only an hour before to remove the last of the trash, and that the TV was definitely not on previously, this freaked me out a little. I sat with the other caregivers for the rest of the shift. The rest of the night was quiet, and I took another job shortly after, so this was my only experience at that facility. I moved on to an emergency room, where I had two similar experiences in empty rooms. TVs turning on, curtains moving that could not have been affected by air conditioning, stuff that you'd probably hear from a lot of hospital staff, but nothing too extreme. It was my third job where I had the most astounding experience. It didn't take place in a hospital or a nursing home. I took 6 months away from the ER to work a home health job in a nice neighborhood in OKC. I'd been caring for this gentleman overnight for a couple months and was outside smoking on the front porch. This very large house had a very large front yard that put it about 150 feet from the street. I was reading and smoking with a monitor with me in case my client needed assistance. It was about 3 a.m. I don't know what made me look up from my book, but when I did, I saw a green orb. The orb was probably a little larger than a softball. It was fluorescent green and appeared to be emitting light. It was moving down the road from my right to left, moving about 30 miles per hour, at a height of approximately 6 feet above the road. The orb traveled down, straight down the road for about 300 feet before simply ceasing to be there. It didn't zip off. It didn't go out of eyesight. It didn't shrink. It just vanished. I walked out to the road and said loudly, "Anyone else see that?" Looking around for anyone else, but the street was completely empty. I've made some attempts to find explanations in the mainstream, but a phenomenon called ball lightning was the closest I could find, and that seems unlikely. I realize the first story is a little mundane and probably common, but it didn't feel common at the time. I have no clue what to make of the orb. It only lasted a few seconds, but I'll remember those few seconds forever. That's not quite all of the stories, but that's all for now. I hope you enjoyed them. Keep up the excellent work at the Scarlet Thread Society. Thank you so much, Jordan. That was incredible. I'd say as far as that orb goes, ball lightning probably sounds like it's the best bet, but as you so astutely noted, that's not nearly a sufficient explanation for whatever that is. That's really creepy, you know, that's the kind of thing that changed J. Allen Hynek's mind when he was debunking UFOs. It was an experience extremely similar to that that began to convince him there was something more to him. So that was a really cool one to hear. Thank you for writing in. Story number two. Greetings, friend. I work in what myself and the others who work there would call a haunted hardware store. Many times throughout the day, strange things happen. We have had product drop off of shelves or come off hooks even when they are secured down. Strange noises and footsteps while opening up or closing. The downstairs storeroom is particularly active. Many times I have been down there only to see something out of the corner of my eye moving around, or caps coming off of spray paint cans and rolling around. Recently, while down there, I saw a hand curl around a shelf unit, and when I walked over to see, there was nobody there. At first we suspected co-workers playing pranks on each other, but everyone has had something happen to them at various times. There was a murder that happened in the store over a decade ago, and the store is located next to a creek. The end. Now, I have to say about that in particular, right? The interesting thing is, I'm not sure just how many of you listen to my home podcast, The Gaslight Hour, but once upon a time, one of my co-hosts related a story of his own where a ghostly hand was, like, curling up out of an ingredients tray at a sandwich shop, and this really intensely reminded me of that. And while obviously there's no connections between those two stories in particular, it does make me wonder why phantom hands in particular seem to be so common. I commend you on your courage, though. Seeing something like that would have freaked me out pretty good. Thank you for sharing. Our next story. I don't believe in ghosts and shit, but this one time, I saw a fucking demon or monster or something. So there I was, in the passenger side of my friend's car, heading east, and we're just driving along in the middle of a bright Arizona day. And as we went along, I saw what appeared to be an abnormally tall woman, blocked from view by an umbrella she was carrying. She was walking west in the opposite direction as us, and I could only see her very pasty white legs and yellow dress. Well, as we got closer to her is when I noticed how tall she really was, but she was hunched over and still probably at least 5'10" despite being hunched over. She seemed odd and out of place, so right about the time we were about to pass her, I looked over to get a better look, and as soon as the umbrella wasn't blocking her face, I got a real good look at her. Her head was cocked to the left, but bent over completely to the right, and she was looking directly at me. She had what may have been a short blonde wig with straight short bangs because it wasn't messed up, and the hairs looked perfectly straight cut. But the terrifying part was that there was no head or face, just a blank black void, and yet somehow she was staring straight into my eyes. It freaked me out. And as we passed her, I did a double take, and the wig and blank black face was still looking directly at me over her shoulder. I looked away again and back, and even though we were further away, she was still staring directly at me with her head cocked around even further. I didn't look away this time and just watched her stare at me with that void of a head/face until we were pretty far away. The entire time, she never broke quote-unquote eye contact with me, and her head just turned further and further as she slowly walked in the other direction. Freakiest shit I've ever seen. It wasn't a shadow. It was an empty fucking wig on a giant hunchbacked lady. I'm going to try and go back to sleep now. Signed, Zach. Well, Zach, that is probably one of the freakiest and strangest examples of a creature encounter that I personally have ever heard, especially out there in the southwestern deserts of the United States. This sort of thing is not actually terribly uncommon, where you'll run into strange entities just in the middle of the day. You know, the American desert is some of the most haunted place, contains some of the most haunted places in the world, and this certainly wouldn't seem to be any exception. Now, very clearly, you weren't asleep, or it could be dismissed as a dream, but I would defy anyone listening to try and explain to me how something like that could happen, or what that could be when a person is wide awake, seeing it with their eyes directly in front of them. So, I suppose just as a final note, I sincerely hope you never have to meet that lady again. Thank you for writing in. Our next story. So this story takes place on spring break of my senior year of high school, all the way back in March of the year of our Lord, 2001. My buddy and I were mad that we could not go to Cancun with the rest of our friends on spring break vacation. The main reason was our parents were good people and did not want their baby boys drinking bathtub tequila and senior frogs in the land of overpass hangings. We were disgusted with our parents' criminal short-sightedness for fun, so we had to cook up some other way to amuse ourselves for the 9 days off of school. We came up with the great idea of going camping in Wyoming in March. The problem was we lived in Iowa, and our parents would not have allowed us to go there either. But you don't need plane tickets, credit cards, and a passport to go to Wyoming. So we just lied. This was before mass cell phone use and tracking stuff with GPS, so we just said we were going camping in northern Iowa to go trout fishing. So we spent all day Saturday getting together all our camping and fishing stuff for the week and loading it into my buddy's 1991 Honda Civic. It took forever. So we did not get on the road until like 3 p.m., headed westbound on I-80, lighting out for the territories, heading upriver, so to speak. Western Nebraska is a lonely place at 2 a.m. I-80 is almost empty. Like, you can cruise for 5 to 10 minutes and not see anyone else on the road. But we did see someone else, signaling way out in front of us, and they pulled over to the shoulder with hazard flashers on. So we got over in the left lane to give him some space, and right as we are passing by the car at 70 miles per hour, we see the guy running towards the center line, and he tried to jump in front of us. My buddy was driving, so he swerved to the median, missed the guy, and dropped a tire into the grass. But he kept it under control. He was a good driver and fancied himself a regular coal trickle. His favorite movie was Days of Thunder back then. So we are screaming, and he is slowly getting the car back up off the median without overcorrecting and going into the other ditch. He gets it under control, and we just keep on going. All freaked out that a guy just tried to jump in front of our car. If that was the whole story, it would be interesting, but not all that spooky. Here is where it gets weird. So about 20 minutes goes by, and we are calming down and still cruising west on 80, and start seeing signs for Pine Bluffs, Wyoming, 60 miles out, still on a deserted interstate. Very few cars and trucks. When all of a sudden, this semi is right on our ass. Like 20 feet behind us with his brights on, lighting up the whole inside of the 91 Honda. I turn around and look out the rear window and see its round headlamps and amber marker lights right behind us, which is very strange for a deserted interstate. We were in the right lane, so I say to my buddy to tap his brakes to take it off cruise control to get this asshole to go around us. I can't stress this enough, that this truck has this tiny Honda lit entirely up. I'm holding my hand up, shielding my eyes because the light is reflecting off the side mirrors and blinding me in the passenger seat. So my buddy taps the brakes, and it's like a switch was flipped from on to off. It's suddenly dark, from halogen daylight to 3 a.m. Western Nebraska dark. I say, what the fuck? Where did that truck go? I turn around, and there is nothing behind us. I'm still looking backwards when a car crests the hill way behind us to light up the roadway, and there is nothing but empty interstate around. No Peterbilt lit up like a Christmas tree. No other vehicles except the car hundreds of yards behind us, and most importantly, no off-ramps or exits. The truck is not there, so we are really freaked out now. Disappearing Peterbilts, suicidal assholes trying to jump in front of our car, and we have to piss real bad now. So we get off a few exits later, still freaked out, and try to find a gas station, but it's some super small town, nothing open past 8 p.m. type town. So we decided to pull over on the side of the road, just outside of the town, and take our leak there. So I get done, and I'm waiting for my friend to finish, when I notice he is relieving himself on some sort of sign for whatever is on the other side of the ditch. I can't make out what it says, so when he gets done, I shine a flashlight over, and it's for the town cemetery. We jump back into the car, and at that point don't stop till Laramie. That truck still bothers me to this day. I am a truck driver now, for the past 10 years, and I have seen all sorts of shit. Shooting victims under white sheets on a sidewalk of South Chicago, terrible wrecks with multiple deaths, steel coils that rolled over the top of cabs, steel I-beams through truck cabs, truck dealers yelling at hookers while I'm waiting to get unloaded in some shithole. I even saw two Amish kids fist fighting once in Pennsylvania. All that stuff makes fairly logical sense. Horrible, tragic, or strange, but it's at least understandable. But that disappearing truck still sticks in my mind as the strangest thing that has happened to me on the road. I still don't know what happened. Me and my friend who I took the trip with just called it the ghost trucker as a joke. But I don't believe in ghosts. So it's just an unexplained anomaly from my youth that I can still picture in my mind, clear as day when I close my eyes to remember it. Hope you enjoyed the story. Matt E. Well, Matt, I have to say, you probably should start believing in ghost stories, because the American interstates are, like the Southwest Desert, some of the most haunted places on the planet. And I think you yourself got a real good look at just why people make that claim. You know, disappearing trucks, cemeteries, other drivers driven mad. There's no way to reconcile any of that. And you weren't asleep. It's not like your mind was playing tricks on you. And if your buddy saw it too, well, you know, that's multiple witnesses right there. I don't know what more skeptics could want, but I think I'm entirely satisfied saying you either met yourself a ghost trucker, or that truck disappeared through some kind of time slip. Because that, too, is the sort of thing that happens all over the place out there. Our last story for this month's episode comes to us from friend of the show, Cotton. I was in Auburn, Alabama in August 2020 and drove from Louisiana. The drive there was easy. I drove to Monroe, Louisiana, and hopped onto I-20 and was there in no time. Interstate miles go by a lot quicker. The drive back was a different story. I was tired and decided not to fool with maps and just relied on my phone's GPS. My phone took me on a very odd route. It seems like it was the longest possible way to get home, but I was listening to an audiobook and was determined to power through the back roads and get home. The scenery was beautiful, but I drove through a lot of out-of-the-way, forgotten towns. It was about 9 p.m., and I was driving through a series of sugarcane fields in Mississippi when I saw a structure in the distance. I figured it was a grain silo due to those being fairly common in my area and thought not much of it. After about 10 minutes, I realized the structure did not grow larger in the horizon. This was incredibly odd, considering I was driving straight towards it. I run through every possible explanation in my head, but I could not justify such a large structure existing in the middle of nowhere in central Mississippi. Another 10 minutes go by, and the size still has not changed. I start to get very anxious. I ended up driving straight towards the structure for about 40 minutes, and it's now nearing 10 p.m. I was driving for nearly 6 hours before this and nodded off for an incredibly brief moment, as most long-distance drivers do at some point. And I immediately noticed the structure was now no longer there. I stop at the nearest gas station, figuring I need coffee and a stretch. While there, I look around, and there was no sign anywhere of what I saw. Since this incident, I have searched for structures matching the silhouette of what I saw and can find nothing that exists in that area. I have also searched for similar paranormal experiences from that area and have found nothing. I have never been a superstitious guy, and when I was younger, I would have laughed at a story like this. But I can say it is the most inexplicable thing that has ever happened to me. Yeah, Cotton, I think you and I discussed this a little bit on a Discord voice chat one night. And I have to say that this is, as we've mentioned a couple of times here, rather serendipitously on the episode, it sounds like it's a classic time slip story. Or like the veil got thin on those back roads you were driving on, and you started to get a glimpse into a world that wasn't quite our own. Now, I know that can be quite scary in and of itself, but there are thousands of those stories from travelers out there, and you are far from alone. That might be a comfort to you, or that might make the experience even scarier. But yeah, the mysterious obelisk that's not actually there, that's not new. There's hundreds and thousands of them. And, you know, whether or not they'll get more common as the timeline gets weirder, That remains to be seen, but I wouldn't bet against it. Thank you so much for writing in, Cotton. All right, folks, and now for our main event of the evening. One of the funny things about being a conspiracy theorist is that we are constantly leveled with the charge that we must justify our positions above and beyond so many others. A conspiracy theorist is always presumed to lack evidence or to somehow be wildly off base. It never has and never will matter how many times any number of different boogeymen get caught with their hands in various cookie jars. From the Banana Republic coups to chemical warfare experiments in San Francisco, all the way to things like weaponized Lyme's disease and LARPing as vampires in the Philippines, it doesn't matter what they do, they are always presumed innocent. This mockingbird-seeded presumption of innocence must end. Almost nothing could be more important. And now, speaking of mockingbird, perhaps we should also take a moment to reflect upon one of the most successful disinformation campaigns in world history. Surely anybody listening to this podcast has heard of the Satanic Panic, even if some of the youngest listeners don't necessarily remember it like it was yesterday. This was an all-out media blitz that lasted almost two full decades, designed to convince boomers and the older members of Generation X that rock and roll, movies, Dungeons and Dragons, and anything that smelled even a whiff like pop culture was actually a literal demonic plot to steal people's souls. At its zenith, it resulted in a streak of preschools and daycares around the country being forced out of business after media-stoked witch hunts convinced the public that young children were being sexually abused across the nation in order to feed the urge of perverted devil cults. What people are less eager to remember about this period, or perhaps are entirely unaware of, are the rash of military daycare closures and politician pedophilia scandals that rocked the US and also the UK. I always wondered if it's a coincidence that these stories ended up buried at the absolute height of this moral panic. One could look at this absolute hegemony that the intelligence services hold over the media and easily come to the black-pilled conclusion that they just can't be fought and that they can dictate reality around us through their mouthpieces. Our blessing is this, though. There are no unified fronts among these spooks and glowies. Every group of intelligence agency bastards serves their own ends and their own set or sets of masters in turn. This can bring them into conflict, and that is for the people's benefit. The more they are forced to fight each other, the less they can do things like this to us. And that is what I want you to meditate on here briefly as we introduce our next unit of government cover-ups and declassified documents for the Scarlet Thread Society. You see, our next unit is the recently, as in fall of 2019 recent, declassified police case files of the investigations into a group, a cult known as the Finders, or sometimes Finders Keepers. The Finders were ahead of their time in many ways, in being communalistic before the hippies really came about, in knowing that credentials were not as important as demonstrable knowledge, and in being an intelligence-gathering service in a time when only nation-states and state-level actors like Galen thought they could do such things. None of this saved them, however, from becoming the decades-long pawns of the Central Intelligence Agency before their story rather abruptly peaked and ended in a federal turf war one winter day in northern Florida. Before I get too far ahead of myself here, though, I think it's time we discuss just what happened and why it matters so much to us yet to this day. In early February 1987, Tallahassee police stopped a nondescript van in a city park. There were two adults in the van, which would be no cause for concern normally, were it not, however, for the fact that in the back of the van were six young children, dirty, and who had evidently been without any kind of bathroom facilities for quite some time. Neither of the two adults had any relation to any of the children, nor any forms of identification. If you think that isn't strange enough, what would happen next is even stranger. As the police approached the adult suspects, one of them claimed that they were taking the kids to a special school in Mexico for brilliant children, and the other suspect laid down on the ground and began yelling gibberish. It was at this point that the children were taken into protective custody, and the two adults were arrested on suspicion of child abuse. Over the next several days, the two suspects were identified as members of the Finders. It was then that charges of obstruction of justice, sexual exploitation of children, and violations of the White Slave Trafficking Act were announced and a formal investigation began. The investigation originated primarily with the Tallahassee Police and then with the DC Metro Police joining them, which is where the Finders were found to be headquartered. Finally, U.S. Customs would become involved when suspicions of child pornography became relevant to the investigation. It was shortly after this that search warrants were acquired for the Finders' properties in Florida and Northern Virginia. Customs agents, with the assistance of the aforementioned police agencies, executed these warrants as soon as they became available. Northern Virginia, in particular, they were well on their way to finding plenty of information, including rounding up a series of computers at their compound that included clear written instructions in files in them, detailing various ways that young children could be procured, including by calling contacts at various embassies, making female members of the cult pregnant, and ways to evade law enforcement if you just so happen to find a child. So here we are, with the police and customs agents swarming the Finders' properties, when, as they are wont to do, the FBI shows up and shuts down the investigation and warrants, at least for the day. While all this is going on in Northern Virginia, back in Florida, two of the six children are showing clear signs of sexual abuse after being given physicals. And the suspects, the two that were arrested in the van, are entirely uncooperative. The next day, after the warrant investigations were shut down by the FBI, the investigation resumes with FBI, Foreign Counterintelligence, now the self-appointed leaders, with guidance coming to them from the State Department Passports Division, of all places. It was now, at this point, that Virginia State Police is also helping to execute the search warrants in Northern Virginia. While the now-released reports don't make mention of why or who, I would note at this time that the Virginia State Police are one of the few LEO groups in the country with a dedicated cults unit. Eventually, the searches are concluded. In addition to the computers, child-sized cages were also found all over the North Virginia property. At no point, interestingly enough, did the FBI agents pretending to lead the search show an active interest in examining any of the things that were found. This, according to police department observers in their reports. Over the next few days, dozens of members, ex-members, affiliates, and even embedded agents and CIs are also interviewed by the police. The consensus of all these folks is that the group, the Finders, was founded in the early 60s, and that it had been under federal, quote, surveillance, unquote, since at least 1971. When an undercover CIA agent in particular was interviewed, the agent was asked if this investigation was stepping on any toes, to which they replied, kind of. This would seem to explain why members of the Finders were able to travel with impunity to restricted countries like China, North Vietnam, and parts of Africa. It would also seemingly explain the State Department's sudden interest in being involved. This is approximately the point where the Department of Justice decided that despite the computers that were found, which now also includes an additional one turned up from the Florida properties containing active instructions and contacts lists for the two suspects who are still being held in custody, not to mention the signs of abuse on two of the children, that there just was not enough evidence to charge the two suspect Finders with anything. The children were returned to their parents once they were located, and the two suspects were released. And that, seemingly, would be the end of it. Fast forward to 1993, and a congressman rose from Florida. This according to the documents, when in reality there wasn't an active congressman rose, at least not from Florida, in either the 102nd or 103rd Congresses, is demanding a reopening of the investigation into the Finders, and he seems to get his way. It is easy enough to allow, though, as the Finders had disbanded between the initial investigation and this reopening. Now, there are still a lot of pieces floating and missing around here, and for that reason, my notes for this episode and a link to the Finders files will be included in the show notes if you wish to peruse them for yourselves. There's a lot that I still haven't gotten into. The FBI website has released these files in three clearly, cleanly separated parts. These actual investigation reports from all the various investigating agencies were the first part. It may seem that this was really only 15-20 minutes, of actual Finder's content in this episode, and that's because I had to read every part of this that I just relayed to you in 5-copy before I was actually able to sort any of it into a script. So you have my apologies for that. Part 2 of the Finder's Files will be coming up in July. I have no idea what's going to be in there yet, but the juiciest bits of information sitting here in my notes outline still have no connection to anything that I've said. So there's going to be a lot coming up if you're willing to just be a little patient with me, and I expect we're going to get into some really, really wild stuff here with the Finders, especially once we get into the Franklin cover-up connection. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Thank you for listening to me here at the Scarlet Thread Society. Goodbye. I love you.